Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. MTSU's Industrial Organizational Psychology program has had two students winning a very prestigious national award within the past 4 years, which is an unprecedented distinction. The award is the Outstanding Graduate Student of the Year Award from the Society for Human Resource Management. One of those winners is here with us today, Jaye Murray, who is an IO Psychology Master student. He was up against both doctoral and master students across the U.S. from all human resources related fields. More than 140 nominations were made, and Jaye was one of only four selected for the award this year. We're going to be talking to him about his honor and about what industrial organizational psychology is and what kind of careers are available for people who choose this discipline right after a few well-chosen words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. Copies of Scientia et Humanitas, a journal of student research, are available in the University Honors College office. The annual student research periodical includes examinations of such topics as the use of hip-hop music to encourage critical thinking and how interfaith dialogues are used to promote peace in southern Thailand. And a new doctoral degree program at MTSU is the first of its kind in Tennessee. The Doctor of Education in Assessment, Learning, and School Improvement will begin in the fall of 2013. It's intended to help pre-K through 12 educators improve their students' academic achievement. For MTSU News at any time, go to MTSUnews.com. That's MTSUnews.com.
Jaye Murray, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
What did they base it on?
So most of it was an online form that I had to fill out. The online form required me to fill out a few surveys, my GPA, my past work experience, my classes, my favorite classes, and so forth. They also required me to submit at least one letter of recommendation, but I submitted two, just to be safe.
Did you have any undergraduate research that you submitted, any term papers or anything like that?
No.
For those of us who are uninitiated, tell us exactly what industrial organizational psychology is.
So industrial organizational psychology is a field where we study work behavior, and we can do that through different ways. We do it through measuring performance, measuring compensation, using training efforts. There's a plethora of ways that we can do that. And a master's program focuses more on an applied aspect versus a PhD, which focuses more on the research aspect.
Tell me where the psychological part comes in. What type of analysis or analytical tools would you use?
There's multiple. You can use focus groups, statistics. I guess the psychological part would come in the fact that we are trying to study what people will do and how we can make them perform better in their organizations.
So one of the things you might consider is how managers can be better managers, how employees can deal with managers when there seems to be some friction or cognitive dissonance there, that type of thing.
Correct.
How colleagues can collaborate when they need to do group projects, and how they can work alone when they are on singular projects and they're up against deadline pressure, all those types of things, right?
Correct.
What sorts of careers loom before you, career choices, after you graduate? Well, I mean, you know what, might know what exactly what you want to do, but what other sorts of choices are on the spectrum for people to choose from in your discipline?
So there's a lot. You have a few depending on what route you go, whether you go PhD or master's. If you get a PhD, you can go into university and teach, do research. You can also go into consulting firms. You have specific consulting firms totally geared towards industrial organizational psychology graduates, or you can go into a more general consulting firm like Deloitte, your Booz Allens, your McKinsey and companies. A lot of people also go into human resources. So you can go into learning about selection systems, training, compensation. So there's a wide variety of careers that are available.
What exactly would you like to do when you graduate?
I'm looking into the federal government right now.
Okay.
And doing human resources for the federal government.
Now, I've looked at some job descriptions on federal government websites, and the parameters are usually very, very specific. It's a different kettle of fish from going for a job in the private sector, isn't it? I mean, there are specific governmental classifications. Some jobs are civil service and some aren't. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So what I'm applying through is the Presidential Management Fellows Program, which is a program only open to graduate students in their last year of graduate school. And whether that's master's, MBA, PhD, it really does not matter. And I'm applying through that. And so for them, it's a little bit different. They do lift your classification levels. You know, your GS is through, you know, as we start off at G9, you can go up to a GS12. That's your salary range. But it's more about rotational opportunities, and they try not to pigeonhole you into one particular thing. So what I'm trying to do is start off in human resources and work my way around, let's say, budgeting or general administration, and trying to find more what I want to do or mix my skills together.
Does the quantitative or qualitative aspect of this discipline interest you more?
I prefer the qualitative aspect. I appreciate the quantitative aspect. I do appreciate statistics, but I prefer the people aspect, which is more of the qualitative, talking to people and finding out their issues and trying to work with them on a personal level.
What made you become interested in this particular area of expertise?
So when I finished undergrad, I went straight to grad school and did a master's in international business. And then I worked for 2.5 years in the hospitality industry in supervisory management roles. And while I was in those roles, I realized that the business side of things really didn't catch my attention as much as the people side of things. But I didn't want to really let go of the business. And so I tried to find a field that combined the best of both worlds. And I found IO psychology.
What did your parents do for a living? And did they ever come home and gripe about the boss?
My mom is a nurse. And my dad's a physician, so my dad's an anesthesiologist. He's head of his department, so he really didn't have much to answer to except the head of the hospital, and he was on good terms. But my mom, yeah, I did hear some stories about my mom, and then me with personal experience. I had some wonderful, wonderful boss and supervisors, and some that I think could have used a little bit of work. And so I thought, what can I do to help those kind of people who need work and help them out in a positive way?
This is a subject that's very pertinent to the current economic condition of the country, because with the unemployment rate so high, a lot of people feel trapped in jobs in which they are rather unhappy. But as much as they'd like to go somewhere, they can't afford to just pick up stakes and leave because they need health insurance, or they need the money, or they've got a mortgage, they've got kids to put through college, and so on. Can you empathize with the quandary that they find themselves in?
Yes, I can, because I was not sure if I wanted to go back to school because of that same situation. I was scared that I'd go back to school and not be able to find a job coming out, and so I was debating whether it was just to be better to stay in a secure environment where I was in a pretty decent job with some pretty nice promotional opportunities, or really go for what I wanted to do. So I can definitely empathize with that situation.
We'll be right back to talk more with J.A. Murray on MTSU on the Record after this.
Tennessee's farm families contribute to our state's economy, nutrition, and culture. The Tennessee Century Farms program at MTSU's Center for Historic Preservation acknowledges farms that have been in the same family for at least 100 years. To date, the program has certified more than 1,000 farms. This is Kenita Hankins, director of the Tennessee Century Farms program.
And for all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
J.A. Murray is our guest today on MTSU on the Record. He's an industrial organizational psychology major going for his master's here at MTSU, and the winner of the Outstanding Graduate Student of the Year Award from the Society for Human Resource Management. What class gives you the most intellectual pleasure? Which one have you found to be the most intriguing so far?
That would be my organizational development class.
Why so?
Right now. Because it's teaching me a lot about consulting, and I've never had that kind of skill set before. We've learned a lot of other things. We've learned about selection and performance management and job analysis, but organizational development seems to be the one class that kind of pulls everything together that we've learned and makes us think in new ways. And so I'd definitely say my OD class.
Now, when you talk about organizational development, are you talking about the way a company is structured bureaucratically, the hierarchy, who's above whom, and that sort of thing? Or what exactly do you mean by that?
So organizational development is kind of a broad term. And so it could mean what you just said about hierarchy. Usually when most people think organizational development that are IO majors, they think of things like widespread organizational change initiatives, strategic planning, leadership development, things like that. Pretty much anything on a mass scale that'll affect an organization on a significant level.
Do most companies of a substantial size need consulting help with that, or can they handle it internally?
Depends. If you have a very strong internal network and they're very collaborative inside, you might have an internal consultant. The director of HR could be an internal consultant to help facilitate organizational initiatives. But a lot of times there's a lot of politics to go on inside, and they might need someone from an outside to be a set of fresh eyes and ears, a different kind of perspective, more objective. And so that's when being an outside consultant would definitely be helpful.
What kind of an HR situation is the healthiest for a company? Some might argue that it's not so healthy for the HR employees to be directly answerable to the company, because if they get their same paycheck from the people who issue the other employees' paychecks, then they might feel duty-bound or compelled to give the kind of answers that would make the company administration happy. On the other hand, if the company contracts out with a private firm for their HR resources, there is a certain distance there, geographical and otherwise, human distance, between the HR professionals and the company employees. So how do you weigh those pros and cons?
If HR has the quote-unquote seat at the table and is really next to the CEO or next to high-level executives and they understand the value that they can bring, I don't think there'll be an issue with them needing to, you know, just answer to upper management in the way that they think they want to hear. They'll actually be critical of their ideas and have some valuable input. If that's not the case, then contracting out is probably your best bet. Granted, like you said, there could be that distance. And usually if there is a consulting relationship, they will probably travel to the site anyway. But it'll still in the long run be better for the organization, because then there isn't any bias involved.
But the $64,000 question, I think, is why is there so much difficulty sometimes in communications between management and labor? That's a question that can't be answered within the entire 30 minutes of this program, because it's so massive. But give us just sort of a laundry list of some of the factors that cause this kind of friction or a lack of understanding between management and labor in a company.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with trust and not being able to see the other person's perspective. I've had the opportunity to be on both sides of the coin, where I've been at the lower end and I like a direct report, and then I've had where I've actually been the manager, and I didn't really have to report to many people. So the manager has to look out for the best interest of the company and for the direct reports. And so I'm trying to think of an example. If the manager says, you can't eat past 12 o'clock, let's say noon, throwing out an example, hypothetical. And the direct report's response is, they're thinking, well, he or she's just being mean. You know, they're not thinking, oh, well, my boss might have to answer to someone else who is telling them you can't do that. Or they're not thinking, why is that company policy in place? A lot of the times company policy is in place for a reason. And a lot of the times, to be honest, managers don't explain that very well. Mm-hmm. And so it frustrates the direct reports a lot. And so there ends up being a lot of friction between the two of them.
Do you think it's a good idea to have employee committees that help to make suggestions or to contribute to the formation of the overall company policy?
Yes, but only if they're being listened to properly. And I say that meaning, so there's a lot of times in companies where they'll form these committees because they think that'll make the employees feel great, but then they're not really listening to them. They're just basically having them, I don't know, write notes on a board somewhere and saying, yeah, we'll take care of it. If the employees catch wind of that and realize that you are not telling the truth and you're only doing it just to try to appease the CEO, yeah, it's going to backfire. Mm-hmm. You're going to have problems later on, because they're going to realize, yeah, they're not really listening to us, you know, what's going on. But if you do listen to employees and have some value, they can have some very valuable input. There's a lot of things that managers do not see that go on the floor, and that's when the employees will really come into play.
Organized labor has experienced declining enrollment for the past several decades now. Has the decline in organized labor played a role in how people think about industrial organizational psychology? I mean, Tennessee is an at-will state, and which means you can get fired at any time for any reason, essentially. And the South is notoriously, with a few pocket exceptions here and there, not necessarily happy about labor unions or accepting of labor unions, at least not to the degree that they are in the Northeast. So what does what you're learning in class, or what you have been learning in class about labor unions, organized labor, how does that play into the way you perceive IO psychology?
I think a union makes it a little bit more difficult to do things because the union has standards and you're still going to have to negotiate with management. And a lot of the times, being an IO psychologist, you're being contracted from the management side. So I think it's a little bit more difficult to get buy-in from people who are members of unions as a result, because they're thinking, okay, you're only coming in because my manager made you come in and we're already against each other. And the IO psychologist has to go in there and realize that they need to be very unbiased and very ethical. And that's something that causes problems with both, like I said, the direct reports and the managers. Because if you go in there and say, I'm here as an unbiased party, I'm here to do a task, the manager's thinking, well, we contracted you, so why aren't you on our side? And the direct report's already thinking you're not on their side, when really you want to be on their side. You're there to help. You know, that's why you're in your job. And so I think that's the part where it really affects the most, is getting trust from the parties and really trying to implement any kind of initiatives without any side really giving blame to the IO psychologist.
We'll be back with more with Jaye Murray on MTSU on the Record after this brief break.
The MTSU Department of Art has the newest facility for visual arts in the state, with approximately 50,000 square feet of space, including high-tech computers and computer-driven equipment for multimedia, graphic design, printmaking, sculpture, painting, and ceramics. We feature a visiting artist lecture program and an exhibition program that exposes students to work by national and international artists. This is Jean Nagy, Chair of the Department of Art.
To find out more, visit mtsunews.com.
Jaye Murray is our guest today, a master's student here at MTSU, majoring in industrial organizational psychology. Do you or any of your professors, anybody in your area of discipline, ever encounter business people who look at your specialty and go, industrial organizational psychology, I don't need any psychologist to tell me what to do. I've been in business for 50 years and I know what I'm doing. Did you ever encounter that kind of mossback resistance?
Yes.
All the time?
Yes. Yes, because most people have no idea what the degree is, like you were saying. So they see it and they explain it and they're like, well, like you said, we've been doing business this long, why should we change? And my answer is always saying everything changes and you can't just be left behind. And so we're there to help facilitate that change. So even if you don't use us, at some point you're going to have to use somebody to help you with that. But given the fact that that's what we specialize in, why not use us?
Did you think about, like, maybe this is the direction you wanted to go even in high school? Or did it not start that early?
The original plan was med school. Yeah. I told you my dad's a physician. And then when I realized I didn't want to go that route, I realized I wanted to do psychology and it was going to be clinical. It was my original path. And then I took economics my senior year and I fell in love with business. And so I was like, maybe I should go into IO. At the time, I only thought they had PhDs. And I did research in undergrad for 2.5 years. Realized research was not for me. Did like what I was doing, did like the effect it had, but I realized it wasn't my ideal choice for a career. That's why I went into business with the first master's degree. And then when I was working, decided to do some more research and found out they actually had a master's, terminal master's programs. And then I decided to go back and respecialize. So that's why I said kind of. It started off in high school and it kind of went in waves and then it came back.
Certain kinds of tests, I'm thinking specifically of things like Myers-Briggs tests, that help people determine what their individual psychological work style is, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. It's more complex than that, but there are four different categories, I believe, if I remember the kinds of tests that I took correctly, into which certain people fall, given their psychological makeup, their work history, their work styles, their work methodology. Are those tests helpful to an IO psychologist in doing his or her work?
Some tests are, and many tests are not. You would when you're assessing a test, a lot of IO psychologists will assess reliability and validity of the test, and reliability, seeing if it measures over time, and validity is basically assessing if you want to measure what you're supposed to measure. And a lot of tests do not try to assess the reliability or validity. And so for those tests, they're not useful to IO psychologists because they will feel that it's not really giving any kind of real data to back up the assertions. And the tests that do have that kind of information are viewed as much stronger and useful tools. What IO psychologists don't want to do is go into an organization and tell someone, take this test because we think it'll help you. And then in the back of their minds, they're saying, well, someone could have just written this up yesterday and tried to get it published. So the statistical information is very important to them.
What kind of test would you feel comfortable staking your reputation on? And how do you know which kinds of tests are reliable enough?
You have a lot of different publications that release that kind of information, and you can contact reputable test publishers. You have the Mental Measurements Yearbook that is released, not mistaken, every year that has entire listings of reliability, validity, where they got their subjects, what it's supposed to measure, so on and so forth. And so a lot of people just go through the book and figure out which tests are reliable, which ones are valid, and so, and they measure in terms of how strong they are. And so you also have a trade-off in terms of cost. And so if something is really, really high in validity, but it costs a ton of money, you might end up taking a test that's got some pretty strong validity, not as high as the other one, but it's more cost-effective. So there are sources for that.
It's a very, very scary thing for an employee to think that his or her job might hinge on the reliability or lack thereof of a test. One would hope that the employer would not base 100% of his or her decision-making on any given test, because no test is perfect.
Agreed.
What about legal factors? Some people have an attitude in business on both the employee and the employer sides that there's too much government intervention in the workplace. Everything from resenting OSHA for setting safety standards to resenting the Family Leave Act, FMLA, to resenting workers' comp, all kinds of things. And sometimes a little benign neglect sets in, and then other times some very deliberate neglect sets in of these various local, state, and federal statutes. Does the IO psychologist get involved with that sort of thing?
It depends on what level. For direct government intervention, usually no, but we do have to keep tabs on what the government is doing.
Mm-hmm.
To my knowledge, I don't know any IO psychologists that go and, you know, deal with any of the lawmakers or try to influence them in any kind of way. But we do have to keep tabs because it does have an effect on our jobs. You mentioned FMLA. I'm a good example. Like I said, some IO psychologists deal with compensation, and they need to know what kind of benefits are going around and how they're, you know, changing pension plans and things of that nature.
Say a business has just been hit with an enormous lawsuit judgment by an ex-employee who has sued them, and the judge sided with the employee, and it's a big multi-million dollar hit to the company for egregious violations of federal law, whether it's sexual harassment, racial discrimination, you know, whatever it might be. Would an IO psychologist then come in after, say, the company had cleaned house of the guilty parties and say, would you please, as a consultant, examine my organization from top to bottom to make sure that we are in full compliance and tell us what we need to be, how do we need to reinforce to our managers that they need to be in full compliance with the law and the way they treat their employees?
Definitely. If they couldn't be trusted to do it in-house, yes.
We'll be back in just one moment on MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about industrial organizational psychology with Jaye Murray, one of the winners this year of the National Outstanding Graduate Student of the Year Award from the Society for Human Resource Management. What does this award mean to you personally?
It means a lot of things. It I'm glad that I had an award that appreciated my work, and I'm glad that I had an award that made MTSU stand out. I think I'm really proud of the fact that I was able to represent the IO program in getting the award, because they do list the kind of program you're in, even when they list your name on the website. So.
And industrial organizational psychology is the field of Dr. Patrick McCarthy. He's the graduate program director of the IO psychology program here, and also he's in charge of the MTSU Center for Organizational and Human Resource Effectiveness, better known as CORE, even though it looks like Corey. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what CORE does?
So CORE is a consulting firm that does a lot of different kinds of work. Did work from leadership training, performance management, safety initiatives, you name it, they've done it. So pretty much they're an IO consulting firm that's based out of MTSU.
What kind of money can you make as an IO psychologist in today's market?
Ah.
You must have researched this.
Oh, of course. There's such a large range, and that's why I'm kind of laughing.
Okay, give us a ballpark from what to what, like the lowest and the median and the highest.
Okay, let's see if I can remember from what I've read. I'd say the lowest, and that's if you're going the HR route, because it really depends on if you're going HR consulting. I'd say 45. The median, probably 75, 80 is the median. Upper levels, six figures, 100, 200,000 plus, because you have a lot of IO psychologists that end up running their own consulting firms or end up being the directors of human resources. And then you have some IO psychologists, the people who just have master's degrees, and they might just be a low-level HR generalist coming in off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I said the range of salaries is relatively big.
If there's a young high school student who, after listening to this or looking at literature or seeing something on the internet, thinks that he or she might find this field to be appealing, or maybe there's a freshman here with an undeclared major who might be swayed to take a closer look at IO psychology, what kind of advice would you give them about how to go about getting their feet wet, so to speak?
Getting their feet wet. Well, first thing I tell them is to look at the website for the Society for Industrial Organizational Psychologists. That's the official website for the profession, and that has a lot of great tips actually for students and for professionals. Also, we have a chapter here on campus called MTSU SHRM, so it's MTSU Society for Human Resource Management, which is kind of a hybrid between IO and human resources, where they can consult us and ask us questions and go to our different meetings and so forth. And I would tell them to contact the faculty that are there also, and they can do that by either calling the university and asking which faculty are there, or just going themselves and visiting the campus.
How far are you from completing your master's program?
A few months, actually. Finished classes in April. I'll be graduating in August, though.
Best of luck in the completion of your collegiate career and the start of your business career, Jaye Murray. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.